Morning. May it please the court, I'm Larry Robbins for appellant David Savavian. In the time I have available this morning and subject to the court's questions, I propose to address two errors of law which, taken together, in our view, require reversal of all four counts of conviction. First, I propose to address the instruction on concealment, which affects the concealment convictions contained in counts 2A and 3, and second, the erroneous preclusion of a defense expert, which affects both the falsification charges, those are counts 2C and 5, as well as, under the rule in Yates against the United States, the general verdict of obstruction in count 1. If I might begin with the instruction on concealment. At the government's request and over defendant's objection, the district court instructed this jury that, quote, to conceal by trick, scheme, or device includes, and I quote from page Joint Appendix 1490, any affirmative act or any knowing admission designed to deceive others by preventing or delaying the discovery of information. By framing that over objection, over very precise objections in the disjunctive, this jury was invited to convict Mr. Savavian for the mere failure to disclose his assistance to Mr. Abramoff. That ruling, that instruction, Your Honor, quite plainly contravenes the unmistakable text and holding in the Supreme Court's decision in the United States against Woodward, which
all
says...
Right, and everything here is under A1.
Absolutely.
All right, and your argument as to why it wouldn't be harmless as to count two is that the only evidence under C is of concealment and not of any trick or device?
There are two counts that this could affect. Count three,
yeah,
where, of course, they made no finding on any affirmative act at all. They declined to make an affirmative act finding when given the choice. On count two, Judge Rogers, they did make one finding about an affirmative act in its specification C, but I think it is extremely telling that subsection C, specification C, says that what Mr. Savavian did was falsely state that Abramoff did all his work on Capitol Hill when, in fact, Abramoff was seeking a lease from GSA. The fair reading of specification C, by its terms, is that the jury thought that Mr. Savavian had made what they took to be a false statement in C for the purpose not of concealing his assistance, but as the specification states, for the purpose of concealing Abramoff's efforts at soliciting information about two GSA properties.
Were these personal operations of his, one was for on the two properties, was he representing somebody else in seeking these land?
I think the record does not indicate until after these, the relevant events, whether there was or wasn't a client. There is a point in time when Mr. Abramoff does indicate some people he's working with. And, of course, with respect to the White Oak property, Judge Randolph, there is a relationship with a religious school called Eshcol. So to that extent, the record does reflect a relationship that he's not simply working on his own. But for purposes of the effect of this erroneous concealment instruction, there is simply no way that the government can sustain what this court in U.S. against Wilson recognized to be the traditional Chapman standard for harmless error in the face of an unconstitutional failure to instruct on an element of the offense. So I would respectfully suggest that there is simply no way the government carries that burden of proof. That is their burden under Nieder and under Wilson.
So you're just saying there's an ambiguity about the nature of the affirmative act under specification C.
I would contend that by its terms, the jury has told us that they did not believe that this was for the purpose of concealing his assistance, which is what it would have to be to overcome the harmless error standard. But again, Judge Rogers, let me be clear. What the government has to convince you of, beyond a reasonable doubt, is that this jury would have come out, would have inevitably have found subsection A, even had they been correctly instructed. I don't think the government even undertakes that effort in their brief. I don't think they even acknowledge they have that burden, but yet they do. So I think with respect to counts 2A and count 3, this, what I think is manifestly wrong and objected to, plainly preserved erroneous instruction requires a new trial on those counts.
We've got a number of different arguments about this concealment
yes.
question, but I take the thrust of your argument is that unless there's some affirmative act of concealment, the government has to establish there was a duty to disclose, and they can't do that.
Yes, well, I obviously we have a multi-prong argument, Judge Randolph, and time being fleeting, I can't address them all. But yes, for the concealment charges, they have to prove a duty to disclose. I think they failed. They have to prove an affirmative act constituting a trick, scheme, and device. I think they failed. And of course,
It's sort of like the distinction that if you see a felony being committed and you don't report it, mm-hmm. right, you don't disclose it.
Yes.
Right? You committed no offense, but if you take an affirmative act to cover it up, you're guilty of misprision of a felony.
Indeed.
So that's the distinction.
Absolutely. And the problem with this instruction, and the reason I come back to it, is that this instruction expressly elided that distinction. It said, you know, take one or the other. Take an affirmative act or just a nondisclosure that's willful. But a nondisclosure that's willful. I'm sorry, Judge Edwards.
If we were to find that the jury found a duty to disclose, I'm not opining on that. If we were to find that, would we be able to say they necessarily had to have found an affirmative act?
No, quite the contrary. I think a duty to disclose, you know, I don't think they proved one.
In this, I know you don't.
But taking it as a given, Your Honor.
In this context.
Yes. The fact that there's a duty disclosed does not mean that it was violated by an act constituting a trick, scheme, or device.
Well, not in all contexts. That's certainly true. I'm saying in this particular context, would it necessarily follow that?
I don't think so at all. If you, for example, credit the government's argument that there was a duty to disclose arising from these 14 hortatory principles of good government, I don't see how it follows at all that his failure to come forward in the face of these presumed duties constitutes a trick, scheme, or device. It may constitute a willful nondisclosure, which the Supreme Court explicitly held in Woodward is not enough to violate this prong of 1001. So I guess to answer, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, I'm just thinking.
I guess what I'm saying is if you credit their theory of duty to disclose, it doesn't take you past the duty to disclose.
I just want to understand. This is in the context, at least in part, not put aside the OIG because that's count one. I mean, you're just talking about two and three, right?
Correct.
It's in the context of seeking an ethics opinion.
That's two.
Right. Okay. Now, that's 1001 is not restricted to the executive branch. It applies to the judiciary. We, Judge Rogers and I, were on the Code of Conduct Committee for years, and federal judges are constantly seeking. So is it your reading of the government's position that if a federal judge seeks an ethics opinion and doesn't disclose, quote, all relevant circumstances, which is extraordinarily broad, I mean, relevancy, that they're potentially guilty of a federal criminal offense? Is that your reading of the government's position?
I would say there won't be enough paddy wagons to catch everybody who would be guilty of the criminal concealment theory on which this case has been briefed to this court. I think it's unacceptable. Because time is at a premium and I want to reserve some time for...
Let me just be clear. Your position on this duty to disclose then is in the absence of a statute or regulation or a form or a direct question, then the government does not meet its burden of proof.
Yes.
And the direct question must be fairly explicit. What I'm getting at is when the ethics opinion was written, it included language that Not only had your client said that, I don't have it right in front of me, but it went further than the answer to the question.
Yes.
And the question in my mind was, well, where did the ethics officer come up with that information? But at least we don't have it, or I haven't found it in the record.
No, and you won't, Judge Rogers. As a matter of fact, the government's witnesses were at pains to point to one another as the source, as a consequence of which, Your Honor, the district court dismissed before at Rule 29 those portions of the indictment and refused to send them to the jury that suggested that Mr. Savavian had ever said that Abramoff wasn't even seeking business. Those weren't even submitted to the jury. That's the problem the government has. Now, I want to make sure I touch on the other counts, because all the other counts, including count one, the obstruction count, also must be retried because of the district court's, I think, inexplicable refusal to permit Mr. Savavian to call his expert on what he meant by the words, or what the words doing business, having business, and work typically mean in his business setting.
Well, the judge says it wouldn't help the jury, or it would confuse the jury.
Yes.
And as I understand it, your point, and I need to be clear on this, is not that you were going to ask the expert, quote, the ultimate issue in the case, but rather whether one who deals in government contracting would use these words in a particular way. I mean, you say this would be a corroborating witness.
Precisely, but a corroborating witness of the most important sort. I mean, the fundamental defense, but let's be clear, Mr. Savavian's basic defense was, when I use these words, I do not mean, and I did not mean, what laymen typically mean by these words. I use them as government contract professionals do, and what's more, there's reason to infer that my audience heard them that way, because that's who I was speaking to. Now, the district court said, but wait a minute, these words have an ordinary layman's meaning. The jury doesn't need help with those. And I would suggest that that's the punchline. But that's the ultimate question for the jury. Is it a layman's meaning or is it not?
The ultimate question for the jury, that's what I'm trying to clarify here. Exactly what this expert is going to say beyond what he already said.
Well, the proper is contained, Your Honor, so that there's no mistaking it, at Joint Appendix 201.
Thank you.
What Mr. Anakief was permitted to say was nothing more than sort of how the government contracting process works. You know, what an RFQ is, what an RFP is. But his testimony was truncated in a way that rendered it, I would suggest, utterly worthless to the jury. It was a bunch of acronyms and gobbledygook that wasn't tied to the central question in the case, which is, what do these words mean? Now, he wasn't going to say, let's be clear, he wasn't going to say, I'm going to tell you what Savavian means by these words. That is not his province. His province instead was, I'm going to tell you what people who work in this custom and industry ordinarily mean when they say doing business. And Mr. Savavian testified that he has worked his whole career in a number of different jobs in the government contracting field. And to say that a defendant whose defense turns on this may not call an expert, when on the other hand the government calls laymen, such as a Senate investigator who says in substance, gosh, it sounded like doing business to me. When the case is tried in that way, and he doesn't get to call his expert, he is missing a critical piece of corroboration. I see that my time is just about out, and I'd like to reserve the balance for rebuttal if I could. Thank you, Your Honors.
Now, I just want to pick up on where Mr. Robbins left off. Do you have your brief?
I do, Your Honor.
Yeah. If you turn to page 41 of your brief, at the top, you say the meaning of business and work were properly left for the jury's determination in assessing the defendant's criminal intent. Right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
7 pages later, on page 48 of your brief, You say the experts should not have been allowed to testify about the meaning of business and work because they are legal terms.
I believe...
You see that on page 48 at the top paragraph, left-hand side? He would be opining on specific meanings of legal terms, therefore. Which is it? Is the meaning of these words, are these legal terms, in which case the jury shouldn't be defining them, as a judge should be, or are they just ordinary terms that should be left to the jury? You've got two different positions in your brief.
Your Honor, respectfully, we do not. There are actually two distinctions. There are the terms doing business and seeking to do business, which is what the expert was on Joint Appendix 201, which what he was going to opine upon. These are legal terms of art, which are in the regulations, in terms of what is a prohibited source. Who is one who would be prohibited from providing gifts to a covered executive official, such as Safavian? That is a legal term of art, which we would contend is a specific term.
I don't understand why you say then on 48 that business is a term for the jury to define.
Because the term business in general, having business before, which was the specific phrase which Mr. Safavian used in the ethics opinion, is not a legal term of art. It is a general term which is used and has multiple meanings.
Having business is different from doing business.
According to the regulations, yes. Doing business and seeking to do business are specific terms.
But having business, you would measure contextually as you would any term.
Correct. Having business.
The argument they're making is it's contextual, that is, he's using that term in the context in which he works and using it with someone who is working in that context, and they understand it differently. There isn't a single notion of having or doing business. And isn't a jury supposed to take that into account, measure the context and what people might think of a term, no matter what the term is?
The term was, the judge determined that the term, his opining when a, and that is what was in Joint Appendix 201, what he was going to opine upon, is when conduct becomes doing business or seeking to do business. That was ultimately not what the jury was to determine. They were, in some senses, determining what he meant by and whether he was attempting to mislead the ethics officer by using the term having business. He has no business before GSA. He does all of his work on Capitol Hill. Ultimately, those terms are different than the technical procurement terms, which
I'm not understanding that. If someone uses a term in a specific context, I don't know why it's unfair for that person to say, we have a notion of business in this operation. We all understand what it means. I don't care whether it's doing or however you preface it. Business with this operation, we all understand what that means in this context. And that's what I meant to say. And then he attempts to introduce an expert who will not confirm what he meant as a subjective matter, but that in fact, the word business, or the notion business, does have a limited meaning in the context where he operates. I don't know how that's not admissible.
What Mr. Anakief was proposing, his testimony was to define when the conduct would be considered doing business. And the judge determined in the exercise of his discretion that it would be more confusing than helpful, because the technical procurement terms, which he was going to be using, would be more confusing for the jury under Rule 403 and 702 than the discussion of the layman's terms, the use of the word business and...
The layman's terms are broader than the context that he wants to testify in. That's the problem.
Exactly. And the scheme which was out there and which was put forth and Safavian argued was that he was claiming these technical procurement terms, when in fact the jury determined that he was attempting to conceal those, that he was using these terms in a sense as a misdirection, that he did not have.
But the only evidence they had was his testimony and your lay testimony as to what these terms meant.
That is not correct entirely.
What evidence did the government offer?
There was a significant amount of testimony by our witnesses, not directed by
Mr. Voltz.
Mr. Voltz did testify, but also Mr. Costa, who is a GSA procurement individual.
And were they qualified as experts?
They were not qualified as experts. Mm-hmm. And we were not attempting to qualify them as experts, because ultimately we were not saying that this was something for expert approval. We would say that these principles.
So the man on the street would understand what a government procurement contractor meant.
Well, what we actually, what we were arguing is that Abramoff's business, Abramoff's work, was not procurement. He was a lobbyist. And ultimately, if you review the facts that were out there,
but
he was
the
not.
Defendant was.
Defendant was also a lobbyist. He was a lobbyist for Jack Abramoff. He was a lobbyist prior to his time in becoming
but
a procurement
But you don't deny
expert.
That he had significant government contract experience before coming to GSA, do you?
We would admit that he had some. We would also. We would also say that his use and his primary profession prior to his time was as a lobbyist, not as a procurement specialist.
All right, but in his current job as chief of staff, GSA, and he's using these terms, you're saying he's only acting as a lobbyist?
No, we're acting. We're saying that he's acting as chief of staff to the administrator.
And just this isn't helpful to the jury in any manner to clarify what's going on here?
For this court to reverse it.
No, I understand your abuse of discretion standard. It's very deferential to the district court. But let's understand what the district court had in mind.
The district court made numerous findings in terms of the expert, one of which was that it would be more confusing than helpful.
Why? What's confusing?
Because
that's putting the jury at a very low level of intelligence. What's tricky about explaining what we mean by business and government procurement? That's not a hard concept.
Well, because ultimately the issue was not before the jury about what it was in government contracts.
All right, well, then what's the, my question is not that. My question is, what was so tricky that the jury would be confused?
That by discussing specific procurement terms when we are discussing what a lobbyist is doing, that would be more confusing than helpful to the jury. That consequently, by describing all of these various contracts of an RFQ, of an RFP, and opining specifically of when that conduct equated to doing business or seeking to do business.
But see, that's my point. Your answer to Judge Edwards is, when acting as a lobbyist, how a lobbyist uses these words. This man is now chief of staff at GSA.
But Mr. Safavian was describing Abramoff's work, Abramoff's business. So he was not describing Mr. Safavian's job. He was describing what Abramoff was doing.
Suppose it was clear that everybody in GSA, up and down every hall, on every floor, whenever they use the phrase, does he have work with GSA, is talking about whether the individual has a contract. Would that be relevant?
It would be relevant,
would that
yes.
Would be confusing to the jury?
It could be confusing in terms.
Wow. That's like saying anything is confusing to the jury. And it's very self-serving.
It is ultimately the district court's, in the district court's discretion of looking at what is before them in terms of not only the principles.
And we got you on the standard of review, okay? We're with you there, but you're going to still have to play this out because you can abuse your discretion.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so that's what we're probing.
And then I would move to some of the other aspects.
His defense was literal truth.
His defense was literal truth and ultimately good faith.
And an element of establishing that defense was showing that it was literally true, right? And his argument is that the judge cut him off, that he put an expert witness on to try to show it was literally true, and the judge wouldn't let him do it.
Literal truth is the defense under the law is that it is the only possible interpretation. And if that is his defense, that it was literally true, the only possible interpretation, that clearly is not something which the expert could opine upon. Because there are multiple definitions, as has been discussed here, there are multiple definitions of what business and work are. And consequently, literal truth being the only possible definition as
a
defense.
Does that come from Bishop? The Supreme Court said that in Bishop?
It comes from a wide variety of cases. I do not recall specifically in Bishop.
Let me ask you on another topic where something comes from. You propound the principle that once you start talking, you have to disclose all relevant facts of the government.
That's correct,
Your Honor. Day in and day out, depositions are taken in cases that the government is involved in. And a government lawyer will be asking a private witness who is counsel questions in a deposition. That witness is talking. And I can guarantee you that day in and day out, private counsel is advising the witness, don't volunteer. Just answer the particular question. keep your mind open for the question and don't go straying. Don't give all relevant facts. Are what we witnessing then criminal offenses taking place all throughout the United States on a daily basis, given your principle?
I would not, Your Honor.
What's the difference?
The very specific difference that you have said is that they are private citizens. We would contend that public citizens have a greater obligation to be truthful than do private citizens based upon all of the various regulations that we've discussed. And consequently, these principles can. They do not have to.
1001 applies both to private people and to government.
Correct. And that in order for them to have a duty to disclose, that duty must be based in some form on some regulation.
So the principle is once a government employee starts talking, they have to disclose. And you're not even clear. Another thing I noticed in your brief is on page, I think it's 19, where that may be where you state this principle without citing any authority. You talk about a duty to disclose all relevant facts, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And then, I don't know, 10 pages later, you're talking about a duty to disclose all material facts. The notion that you have to disclose all relevant facts, not even the SEC requires that in the filing. It's materiality that matters, and the fact of the matter is 1001 doesn't talk about relevant facts, it talks about material facts. So which is it?
It is material facts, and that is the limitation which I think addresses a lot of your concerns about the broad reach of 1001 and what we are discussing at this point.
To get this principle, one of the things you do rely on later is the regulation, the government-wide regulation, right? And that doesn't talk about material facts. It talks about relevant facts.
There are numerous principles upon which we rely and regulations upon which we rely in order to determine that for the jury, that the jury could have based their finding upon that there was a duty to disclose. And this is a challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence.
Let me just back up. When Judge Randolph asked about federal judges, my experience in serving on the committee is the committee will give you an opinion based on what you tell them.
Correct.
But if you don't tell them something that's material, the opinion may not be worth the paper it's written on.
And that is the same in the GSA.
But yes.
Can I interrupt you,
Judge Rogers?
Go ahead. That's a very important point that Judge Rogers just made, and yet you take a look at your brief on page 28, at the bottom of 28. That this defendant deliberately withheld critical information in order to obtain an ethics opinion that permitted him to engage in behavior he would be prohibited from if he had disclosed all relevant information. He could have engaged, it didn't matter what he disclosed. The ethics opinion didn't give him permission to engage in a particular conduct. If the ethics officer said, don't do this, he still could have done it anyway.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's wrong. Absolutely wrong.
He was seeking an opinion which would give him permission, and as he described it, as a backstop in case he was ever questioned about it.
No, he was seeking, if a judge comes, you get advice, and then you have to make up your own mind about what you want to do and take the consequences. And that's what you and appellant's counsel take issue about whether you can, quote, abuse the system this way, or whether you're undermining the system. But I just wonder, from the point of view of giving clear notice to a, as we all are, I suppose, potential defendant, that if you're going to come forward and ask for an ethics opinion, this may subject you to criminal prosecution, provided the government can show a duty to disclose, and then the fact that I may not have disclosed all material facts will be used as evidence of the trick or device.
There are numerous limitations to having a broad expansion on this, and one of them is criminal intent, that there must be a knowing and willful action here. And the second one is one of materiality. In 1001, there is a whole line of cases which does not criminalize what is termed trivial falsehoods. And that is something which is found throughout the case law and which is a severe limitation.
Go back to Judge Randolph's point. If everybody at GSA understood that business meant you had a contract with GSA, then the defendant's statement that Abramoff's all his business is with Capitol Hill.
The term was actually all of his work
All of his work is with Capitol Hill.
If that was the general understanding, and that was most certainly not the general understanding that was before them, then that would be something which would be relevant. I'm sorry.
Now, let me ask you, what does the court do with the fact that the district court dismissed the counts based on the allegation that there was a violation here because Abramoff was seeking to do business?
We did not dismiss a count. It dismissed a particular phrase within it, the seeking to do business.
Right.
And what it determined was that there was no evidence in the record that Mr. Safavian ever said that, that it was unclear who he had said that to. I think that it is not relevant in terms of the ultimate. It was unclear whether he had spoken it to Ms. Ellison
or
Mr. McKenna.
I thank you.
And consequently,
the Inspector General, count one, mm-hmm. What is it exactly that the defendant said to the Inspector General that supposedly obstructed his investigation?
There are numerous things which he said. One was that he had paid for the trip. Second one is that he had Abramoff had no business with GSA. Third, that he had no business relationship with GSA. Fourth, that he went on a 4-day trip to Scotland rather than a 7-day trip to London and Scotland. And that $3,100 was the amount paid, which purported to be the amount for the entire trip.
Show whether the Inspector General, as I would assume, had access to the exchange when the defendant was seeking an ethics opinion?
Record reflects that the Inspector General did not access that, and there consequently had no understanding of that ethics opinion. In addition, that ethics opinion also only talks about a 4-day trip to Scotland, does not go into any detail about the 3-day trip to London.
The record doesn't show one way or the other, or it doesn't show, or it shows that he did not.
Shows that he did not get that ethics opinion. In the Senate, on count five, what happened was is that Mr. Safavian forwarded that ethics opinion to the Senate investigators. And the Senate investigator, as the victim of the false statement, was saying, my understanding from reading that is that Mr. Abramoff had no connection whatsoever with GSA. But he that was forwarded to the Senate, but was not accessed by the Inspector General.
My impression from that was he had no connection with GSA?
It was Brian Parker, an investigator for the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, one of the victims of.
He was allowed to testify to that?
As in terms of materiality, yes, whether or not it would have an impact on him. In terms of the duty to disclose, there are numerous aspects. They are reflected in our briefs. I see that my time is up, and if there are no further questions, I would rest on our briefs and ask this court to affirm all the convictions. Thank you.
Briefly,
your time's expired, but I'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the expert point, I want to be very clear. Here is what Judge Friedman said as his rationale for precluding the expert. Joint Appendix 1363, quote, the layman's definition of these terms are the best guide for the jury. There's no need for expert testimony. That was the whole point of this trial. That was the whole question before the jury. Is it the layman's definition, or is it the definition that Mr. Safavian testified he had in mind? What this ruling does, it's not just an abuse of discretion. This is pretermining the entire function of the jury. And because of the general verdict on count one, because the indictment alleged multiple paths towards obstruction, and by the way, in the answer Mr. Edmonds just gave to Your Honor's question, there are only two assertions of statements attributed to Mr. Safavian in the indictment in count one. I would suggest all these other things are an effective variance.
One was
I paid for the entire trip, although we say the better reading of the evidence is he said, I paid what Abramoff told me the price of the trip was. And the second one is Abramoff had no business before GSA. So we contend that the error, which we think is quite fundamental in precluding this defense expert, goes to all the goes not only to the falsification counts, which are 2C and 5, but also by virtue of the Yates principle, count 1. I realize I've dwelled entirely in my limited time on the legal errors that would result in new trials, but I hope the court doesn't understand me to be relinquishing at all the several arguments we've made about sufficiency. that would result in outright dismissal. It's simply that, you know, oral argument just doesn't lend itself to certain points as effectively. And I thank the court for its time this morning.